Finally, sunscreen worthy of your skin. Sol de Janeiro's new Rio Radiance SPF 50 collection, where glowing hydration meets sun protection in a beachy and nostalgic set. Confidently embrace your glow with lightweight 100% mineral SPF body lotion, refreshing SPF body spray, and shimmering SPF body oil. Receive 10% off on your first order on soldejaneiro.com, plus free shipping with the code SPOTIFY10.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. On today's show, as part of my series of interviews with the candidates for U.S. Soccer President, I'm joined by Michael Winograd, a New York attorney with a long background in soccer. We talk about his biggest challenge, finding a path to victory, and he shares some promising proposals, including building training centers in each state and a novel idea to introduce promotion and relegation.
One of the interim steps that I've talked about, maybe not today, maybe not for a tomorrow thing, but at least in the closer range, are guest promotion spots. So for example, tell MLS, your teams have bought into MLS, you know, you're not open to relegation. You stay in the league regardless. We will create two promotion spots. Lower division teams can come up. If at the end of the season, one of those teams is within the bottom four, you pick a number, that team drops down and the spot opens up for a new team to come up. If it's not within the top four, that guest spot doesn't open up, and you wait till the next year.
All that and more coming up. Joining me now is Michael Winograd, one of the eight candidates for U.S. Soccer President. He is currently an attorney at Ropes & Gray, one of New York City's biggest corporate law firms, and he has a long background in soccer. He played college at Lafayette, and after that in Israel. He was director of youth and team development for the Staten Island Vipers and an assistant coach at the University of Richmond. Both of his kids are in the U.S. Soccer Development Academy. Mike Winograd, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Grant. Good to be here.
Great to have you here in the studio at Sports Illustrated in New York. I want to start by asking you a question I've basically asked every candidate at one of these interviews, which is, why do you think you're qualified to be the president of U.S. soccer?
You know, Grant, I want to be president of U.S. soccer to make U.S. soccer better. And I think I'm the best candidate for the job for a few reasons. Number one, independence. Number two, a deep soccer background and experience and knowledge. And number three, deep knowledge and experience on the business side. So let me just elaborate on each of those. I have no hidden agendas. I have no sponsors. I have no special ties to any of the constituents. I have one interest, and that is the interest of U.S. soccer as a whole. And invariably and unquestionably, I will put that interest first. Number two, on the soccer side, as you sort of said in the introduction, I've been in soccer my entire life. I've played at the youth, collegiate, professional levels. I've coached at the youth and collegiate levels, and I have managed at the youth and professional levels. So I have a very deep soccer background. For the last 17 years, after the Staten Island Vipers, which, by the way, was not just a management role, I started that team up from scratch with one other person, co-started up the team, the Staten Island Vipers. And I handled everything on the soccer side. When my colleague left midstream to go to the San Jose Earthquakes, where he later became general manager in the year that they won the MLS Cup, I took over the rest of the team and shepherded it through until I went to law school, and the team was poised to make it to the quarterfinals, I think, of the playoffs in its first inaugural season. After that, for the last 17 years, you know, I went to an Ivy League law school, University of Pennsylvania, graduated with several honors, and have ever since 2000, been at the most prominent law firms in the world, representing the largest banks and clients, from Microsoft to Samsung to FedEx Supply to some of the largest private equity firms, Bain Capital, TPG, in the world. In fact, last week I was in London. I had a chance to catch the Arsenal-Chelsea game, which was spectacular. Even though it ended in a 0-0 tie, it was a great game and a great atmosphere. And I was there with my client, who's the CEO of LGIM Properties, who actually funded the development of St. George's Park, the FA training facility in England. So for the last 17 years, I have been working with the biggest companies and banks on their biggest cases, the cases that attract the attention of the CEOs and the boards of directors. I've been in the boardrooms with the boards and the CEOs, advising them, counseling them, coming up with strategies, negotiating settlements. And a lot of what I do, and I say this to clients all the time, if the parties on both sides of the table are rational, we should be able to settle this. Because a lot of what we do involves avoiding tooth and nail battles, which don't typically sit well with big companies with high profiles. And at the same time, a lot of those disputes that they have are with partners that they need to continue to work with in their space, and contractually sometimes they have arrangements that go forward. So the business side, the negotiation, the mending fences, the figuring out ways to articulate persuasively a path forward that everybody will buy into is what I've been doing for the last 17 years at the highest levels.
So if you have a big idea in your campaign for U.S. soccer president, what is it?
You know, my platform has three main points. Mm-hmm. If I had to boil it down to one, it would be the decision-making process. Mm-hmm. It would be the form of governance, making this into an inclusive, merit-based, transparent form of government. No matter how smart one person is, you know, so let me say this. Companies can run differently. You can have very successful companies that run egalitarian, and some that are run by a dictator. And they can run quite well in both respects. For U.S. soccer, I don't think that issuing edicts from an ivory tower in Chicago is the right way to run U.S. soccer. This is an organization with a varied constituency, with years and years, folks who have dedicated years and decades of their lives, who have so much knowledge that no matter how bright one person is, he or she can't possibly know everything they know. You need to involve folks who have their boots on the ground, bring them into the decision-making process. And the reason I pick that one is because that one affects all of the other key things that I've spoken about in this campaign, from decision-making in terms of youth structure, in terms of policies in youth soccer, in terms of selection of coaches at the national team level and venues at the national team level, to equality in women's, with the women's, in achieving equality in the women's programs, to even, how to implement, programs that will reduce the cost barriers, both in pay-to-play and coaching education. That governance style and the decision-making process is central to all of that. And when we change it, it will bring all of those sort of formerly disenfranchised folks into the fold, and we will, bring their input into the decision-making process, and it's going to benefit virtually every aspect of the game.
U.S. soccer currently has a surplus of $140 million, give or take. That's a good thing. It's better than running a deficit like they did over 15 years ago. How do you think it should be spent?
And by the way, the surplus of about $150 million is going to grow, because I think U.S. Soccer just came out in an email that was sent, I think, to all the candidates. They announced that they will have about a $25 million surplus from this year alone.
Oh, wow.
So the way I would spend it is twofold. Number one, you need some money in the bank in case, for a rainy day. And there are lots of other programs to consider in a small way. But the two main ways that I would spend it. One, helping reduce a little bit pay to play. Now, I've talked about five ways to reduce pay to play, and that's one piece of it. There'll be some money going to that. But in large part, what I want to do, and this ties into player development, is build a state soccer center in every state.
Okay.
Larger states, more than one, similar to the number of associations. And that's going to cost some money, and our surplus could cover it right now. And then some. I'm talking about building a center with fields and a full-time state soccer director who will be paid very competitively. We need to get somebody who is, you know, coming out of school or been in the game for a while and saying, hey, I have an opportunity to coach, you know, college at a great NCAA school. I may have an opportunity to coach MLS, but we're going to make the salary competitive enough that it's a viable alternative for the top quality folks to come in as a neutral and skilled, experienced state soccer director. And that person, again, is going to be housed in a state soccer center with fields. And that is going to be part of a very clearly defined path. It will be the centerpiece of the clearly defined path to our national teams. Mm-hmm. One of the problems when you talk about player development, and now we're just sort of talking at the elite level, is there's no clarity. Nobody knows what the path is. Mm-hmm. Just as sort of youth soccer has become a conglomerate of overlapping and competing businesses and leagues that are competing with each other, the path to the national team is as well. There are a lot of organizations saying, we're the ones, we're the all-stars, come follow this path. There will be one path that everybody knows about. Now, that path will involve objective identification and more thorough identification of players. It will not be limited to just cherry-picking from academies or MLS academies or anything else. It will be broad-based, objective, finding the best players in each state, bringing them to that state soccer center on days that will be prearranged, blackout dates throughout the year, and training them efficiently and effectively as part of that path to our national team. But the surplus will go, will cover that. And I think fundamentally the best piece of that surplus will be spent on the state soccer centers and directors.
Interesting. In terms of the process under which national team coaches are hired, that's something that the president has been involved in for a long time. What is the process under which you think national team coaches should be hired by?
And again, this goes back to what I started with. It needs to be an inclusive process. We can talk about the merits of the past decisions, about why Bob Bradley was let go, about why Jurgen Klinsmann was hired, and then why his contract was extended. And you can argue the merits of both sides potentially, but what I'm most concerned about is who made that decision and how was that decision made? What were the criteria? I suspect that if you ask some of the coaches themselves who are involved in this, why were you hired? Why were you fired? I suspect that they wouldn't know what the criteria were for those decisions. And that's a problem. So it will be a transparent process. Transparency brings with it a confidence and integrity so that people know things are being done properly. And it will be inclusive. There will be a committee that has an influential role made up of past national team coaches, past and current national team players, potentially businessmen, because the selection obviously has some impact on the business side of things as well. But we're going to get together a group of folks who are experts in this and varied and come to a consensus and figure out what the best decision for U.S. soccer is.
Currently, the U.S. men's senior coach position there's an acting coach right now, Dave Sarokin, but it's open for a full-time hire. Presumably, that decision will be made after the president is elected of the federation. Who are just some candidates that you think would be interesting to consider for that position?
Yeah, and so again, this would be, you know, I'm happy to share my own personal views, but this is, again, you know, it's a broader discussion with people who are closer and know this. I mean, obviously, Tab Ramos comes to mind. Peter Vermes comes to mind. I mean, those are folks who I think have shown the qualities that at least I would personally look for and advocate for in a national team coach, because a national team coach is different than what you need to succeed as a national team coach is different than what you need to succeed as an everyday manager of a professional team. You're not with the team very often. Right. You need to make sure that you get the selection of players right. You need to be able to inspire those players and manage them as a team in the short times that you're with them and put the players that you have in the right places. You don't get the ability to really mold them over a long period of time working with them day in and day out. So there's a different skill set involved. But, you know, look, Tab and Peter have come to mind quickly, and I'm quite certain there are plenty others who would be in that discussion.
one thing that has struck me, we got two women candidates in this 8-person race very late in the game, not long before the deadline. Mm-hmm. But still, when you look at the leadership positions in U.S. soccer, whether it's the board, whether it's state associations, basically all across the board, there's not many women.
Right.
And what would you do as president to increase the number of women in leadership roles in U.S. soccer?
You know, this is a – let me step outside of soccer for a moment. My law firm, Ropes & Gray, just announced very recently in the last few weeks that our next chairman of the firm will be a woman partner.
Okay.
And we have been at the forefront of issues of equality and basing things on merit and nothing else. The women's game – let me answer that in a couple of ways specifically with respect to soccer. I find it stunning that we are in 2018. When we started this, it was 2017. And we're still talking about issues of equality in women's soccer. There is absolutely no excuse for it. It's inexcusable. It's unconscionable. And so let me be clear about this. When I'm president, if the men are not playing on substandard fields, the women will not be playing on them either. If the men are traveling first class to games, the women will be traveling first class as well. And by the way, I don't think anybody should be playing on substandard fields. If the men have certain technology in their camps, the women will have the same technology. With respect to pay, if the men and women teams decide that they want the same pay structure, there will be equality dollar for dollar. If they decide they want different pay structures, we'll accommodate that, and there will be equivalence in terms of pay. One of the ways to grow the women's game, and this is getting to your point about women in positions of power within soccer, one of the things that I've talked about is the NWSL has done a spectacular job getting to where it is right now. And I truly believe that league is at the point where it's transitioning from stability and survival into growth. Mm-hmm. We need to continue to build the stability and profitability of that league. And one of the ways to do it is to ensure that women know if they play in the NWSL, there are positions for them after their playing career is done. And to recruit, part of that recruitment process is showing them that there are women in key significant roles. And so how do we do that? At U.S. Soccer, it's easy enough. There will be, you know, there is no question that there are significant numbers of women interested in managing within U.S. soccer who are absolutely more than qualified but deserving based on the merits. If they are deserving based on the merits, they will get those jobs. And there will be, no doubt, more women involved in my administration. That is one way. I will, you know, with respect to other leagues and other factions and constituencies within U.S. soccer, as I will say, as I said, and I'll say again repeatedly, U.S. soccer should not be in the business of ramming things down people's throats, but I certainly will make U.S. soccer's interests known to folks and make sure that they are being given due consideration in the decision-making process of others. But in our administration, there will be more women because there deserve to be more women.
One topic that's always a hot-button topic with fans especially is promotion and relegation, which doesn't currently exist in U.S. soccer, at least at the higher levels. What's your stance on it? Is it something that's a realistic thing to bring to U.S. soccer, or is that something that is just a non-starter for you given the development of the sport and where we are right now?
There are a few things that would be as exciting for our pro leagues as having promotion and relegation. It's not a practical reality right now when you've got franchises that are being sold for $150 or $200 million. I think the first thing we need to work on to bring it closer to reality is focusing on the profitability and stability of the lower divisions, mm-hmm. closing the gap between the lower divisions and MLS so that promotion relegation becomes more of a potential practical reality. One of the things that I've offered, and like a lot of these things, like a lot of the initiatives that I and even others have talked about, getting them actually done requires a skill. It requires understanding the interests, in this case, the interests of business folks who have paid a lot of money to become part of MLS and are bound by certain contracts. MLS is bound to them and vice versa with respect to a lot of contracts. Understanding everybody's interests and being able to articulate to them why it may actually be in their best interest to consider promotion and relegation. And again, that's something that I do on a daily basis with CEOs and big companies. One of the interim steps that I've talked about, maybe not today, maybe not for a tomorrow thing, but at least in the closer range, are guest promotion spots. So for example, tell MLS, your teams have bought into MLS. You do not, you know, you're not open to relegation. You stay in the league regardless. We will create two promotion spots. Lower division teams can come up. If at the end of the season, one of those teams is within the bottom four, pick a number, that team drops down and the spot opens up for a new team to come up. If it's not within the top four, that guest spot doesn't open up and you wait till the next year. That at least is an interim measure that attempts to alleviate some of the concerns you might imagine that the MLS owners would feel and give the excitement and almost as a test run, sort of give the, you know, allow for the excitement of promotion and relegation, allow the parties to socialize to the idea, and then eventually continue with the dialogue again, with the hope that we could eventually get to promotion and relegation, because it would be, you know, a very exciting thing for the pro leagues.
For people who have paid attention to this campaign and seen some of the candidate forums, they often say, including me, that you come off well at these forums. But they also, in some cases, don't see a way that you can do enough to win the election. How is this election winnable for you?
You know, it's winnable for the very reason that I think you just said, which is I have appealed in my conversations and I have really resonated and had great conversations with folks on all sides of every aisle. I've sat down with Don Garber at MLS and had a very constructive conversation that ended quite well. I've sat down with Sunil Gulati. I've sat down with Life members. I've sat down with the state associations and the both on the youth and adult side. And I've sat down with the U.S. Women's National Team and the players. I just had a conversation with one of the players on the Athletes Council a couple of days ago. I have appealed to all of those folks. And I think at the end of the day, if you talk about a path to victory, there are some folks who came into this with greater name recognition. And you know, look, if you know, this election is going to go to the most well-known person starting off, you know, or the best soccer player, that's not going to be me. Maybe we'll let, you know, Eric and Hope fight that one out. But I have all of the skill sets, and I think people realize at a higher level than most. I have the whole package. I have the deep understanding of soccer at all levels. I have the business experience at the highest levels. I've got the independence. And I think ultimately, while there may be some candidates out there with name recognition right now and some core support bases, it's unclear to me whether they'll be able to cross aisles and garner enough support to get to the majority. And if they cannot, I believe that people will very quickly turn to me. I've already got a very strong base. I've gotten lots of folks, again, from different factions saying, we're going to vote for you. You are our candidate. We've been extremely impressed. And then I think, you know, even the folks who have said we are supporting this candidate for now have said, but we want you to know we're very impressed with you and we look forward to Orlando and meeting you. So again, I've got a strong base right now. And I think to the folks who are currently supporting others, I think I'm really high on their short list. And I think that broad appeal overall, sort of over, you know, to all corners of the constituency is what is going to be my path to victory here.
Several people I've talked to are expecting a multi-round election, that nobody will get 50% in the first round. Is that what you're expecting?
I am. And it is going to be at that point a negotiation. I don't think many people, although I think some people will profess to know what to expect. I don't think people really know what to expect. This is a new experience for U.S. soccer. But, you know, being in a situation where you need to gain a consensus from parties who have competing interests and are not always aligned is what I do every day. I mean, I will tell you a story. You know, a year ago, I was doing a case for Samsung. And the case was in arbitration. It was a very large case, tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars at issue. And the party said, we can't settle this. I tried, you know, we'd reached out and tested the waters, and everybody said, no way. I said, well, if we can't settle this, come to my offices in New York. Let's sit down in a conference room and see what we can do. And I had the folks from Samsung all flew in from Korea. We had the owners of the other business come in from both Israel and Croatia. And we had this multinational group with major, you talk about competing interests. I mean, these were a lot of money at interest and at the same time operating in the same space. So we needed to figure out a way to resolve this in an amicable way. And I did. And that is the skill set that I think you need to do the job of U.S. soccer in large part. And it's something that I, you know, certainly hope, you know, look forward to at the election to gain a consensus, because I've said this to the other candidates as well. U.S. soccer does not need an election where at the end of the election, somebody is elected and half of the people are angry and bitter for the next 4 years. That's not what we need. We need a situation where somebody can say, you know what? He was my first choice. She was my first choice. But, you know, the person who won was always also my, you know, second choice. I'm happy with that as well. We need to be able to all get behind somebody. And I think that person will be me.
Now, I don't know the details on this, so I'm going to ask you. I saw that you played in Israel. What's the story there? I'm curious.
Yeah, sure. So I played at Lafayette College
for
4 years. And my senior year, we played a game at Adelphi University. They had several Israelis on their team. And a guy by the name of Roby Young, who had coached me in ODP, had come up to me after the game and said, hey, I thought you played great. Would you want to play in Israel? He set me up with a team, went over there, and played with that team had gotten relegated. So I wound up going over to a different team, Hapoel Kfar Saba. Mm-hmm. Somebody made a call and I showed up at their doorstep, you know, a couple of days later, trained with the team for, it was about a week or so. The coach said, okay, you're good enough. Let's see, you know, come with us to Romania for preseason. Went with them to Romania for preseason, came back and they signed a contract and played at Hapoel Kfar Saba. It was a, absolutely, you know, one of the, you know, best experiences, you know, of my life. And the ability to play pro and you and I were talking earlier, and I had mentioned that I have the juniors and seniors from Lafayette soccer's team come over to my law firm every year, and we talk about sort of life after soccer and how you become certain, you know, how you go into certain careers, and there's a little bit of networking as well. And we have about 30 or 40 alumni that come. And one of the things I talk about is if you have the chance to play after college and you love soccer, do it. It doesn't matter what level, because when you are in school, you're pulled in so many different directions. You've got soccer, you've got school, you've got a unique social experience going on, you've got clubs, lots of things going on. When you play professionally, you have the ability to really focus and make soccer your number one, two, and three priority in your life. So that the next most important thing in your life is number four on the list. That ability to see where you can go physically, mentally, technically, is a tremendous experience, and it was, you know, absolutely one of the best experiences of my life.
Nice. I want to give you a parting shot here. We've talked about a lot in a fairly short amount of time. Is there anything you would like to say to potential voters, fans out there, as kind of a last word about your candidacy?
Sure. You know, U.S. soccer right now is at a crossroads. It really is. And we have the opportunity, and we absolutely should be at the absolute top level on the world's platform competitively. And we also need to make sure that in trying to achieve that, we don't ignore the other 99% of the U.S. soccer landscape. And so I would say, think about what this job entails. Think about who else has the soccer knowledge, right? When you're hiring, we do all the time, you know, companies come to us and say, you know, can you help us find a CEO? You know, the board comes to us. And you need to have an understanding of the product, especially in an organization like this. I've got that deep knowledge from all perspectives, youth all the way through to professional, playing, coaching, managing. who is going to have that sort of trifecta of the soccer knowledge and the business experience? And by the way, it's not just being a CEO of a company. It's not just dictating, because as the governance is set up and the bylaws of U.S. soccer are set up, you need to build consensus. You need to lead by bringing people into a consensus building process. Who has, you know, I've been doing that for 17 years. And so, again, I would just say, when you look at this field and you look at where U.S. soccer needs to go and the mending that needs to occur, you know, I've got, you know, all three. I've got that soccer experience. I've got that business and negotiation experience. And I've got the independence. And I would respectfully ask for their vote.
Michael Winograd, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Grant.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Michael Winograd, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Please, if you like the pod, tell your friends, subscribe, like, and review it wherever you get your podcast. It really does help the cause if you do. And check out the new 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available for free now on SI.com. Recent guests include Luis Robles, Taylor Twellman, Julie Foudy, and Yuri Djorkaeff. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.